following teaching is part of a Through the Bible study given by Pastor John Corson at the Applegate Christian Fellowship.
Someone has recently tagged me in an article as being a doom and gloom end of the world teacher. Well, it's funny because such a tag would put me in an elite intellectual category. U.S. News and World Report this past week in their year-end edition says this: alarmism is very much in vogue, says the year-end U.S. News and World Report. As evidence, it offers the following list of current books that are now in print, and I quote these titles: The End of the American Century, The End of the Nation State, End of Affluence, End of Culture, End of Marriage, End of Kinship, End of Conversation, End of Intelligent Writing, End of Education, End of Architecture, End of Art Theory, End of Literary Theory, End of the Novel, End of Science, End of Equality, End of Liberalism, End of the Republican Era, End of Japan Incorporated, End of the Future, End of the World Order, and End of the World, titles from this year being published in our country, in Seoul. They're right. Alarmism is very much in vogue, in style. It's a happening deal. And so if I was tagged that way as being an end of the world kind of guy, I would be in good intellectual elite company. And I would also be right in the flow of the mainstream culturally. Market Facts Incorporated came out with a poll last month. And in this poll, they found 59% of Americans believe the world will end. And 35% of Americans believe the world will end within 2 decades. And 61% of Americans believe Jesus Christ will come back literally. Amazing. And 49% believe the Antichrist is and will be a literal person. So, if I believed in the end of the world, I would be right with 59% of Americans. But, folks, I do not believe the world is coming to an end. Sorry. Why? Isaiah chapter 45, verse 17 quotes directly the Lord declaring the world will be without end. Ephesians chapter 3, a host of scriptures make that clear, that the world will be without end. Now, the world is going to go through a major renovation and remodeling. But, suffice it to say, the Bible is clear. The world will be without end. So I am not an end of the world teacher because I teach the Bible. Nor am I doom and gloom. I am boom and zoom. That is, man, the Lord's coming back, boom, and we're zooming up and out, and that's going to be it. And when we boom and zoom, man, the Lord is going to descend from heaven, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 says, with the shout, with the voice of the archangel, with the trumpet of God. And then the dead in Christ shall rise first, and we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them to meet the Lord in the clouds, and so we shall ever be with Him. Wherefore, comfort one another with these words. Listen, I'm a boom and zoom guy, and I do not believe the world is coming to an end. The world is going to go through a mega renovation, and it needs to. You see, after we zoom out of here in this event called the rapture, when the Lord comes back for us to take us up to heaven, where we will spend 7 years in heaven, we're going to go up, meet with the Lord. He's going to take us to heaven. Why? Because the world needs to go through a massive fumigation. It's called the tribulation in the Bible. That is, the Lord is going to judge this Christ-rejecting sinful world when, after we're taken up, after we're taken out, then He begins to remake and remold and remodel this world through a fumigation kind of process. And that is why, among other reasons, I'm convinced that we cannot, as Christians, be here during the tribulation period. I mean, if you were going to fumigate your house, and you were going to put a big tent over it to get rid of the bugs and the termites that are destroying the house physically, so you call in, you know, the bug killers, and they come over and put a tent over your house, how many of you would leave your kids in the tent when the gas is being pumped to wipe out the bugs that are destroying your house? Don't raise your hand. I hope you wouldn't. Hey, if we, Jesus said, being evil, know how to give good gifts and do good things for our children, how much more will the Heavenly Father with His? Listen, when this world goes through fumigation, He's taking us out, and then He is pouring out His wrath. There's going to be a final attempt to grab the attention of an unbelieving world. And then, after 7 years of tribulation, when we're in heaven and the world is going through this horrific experience described in Revelation chapters 6 through 19, then we come back with the Lord in what is called the second coming. And He establishes His kingdom on earth, and He rules and reigns from Jerusalem, and we rule and reign on His behalf throughout the world. We're located in various parts of the world. I got dibs on Maui. That's a done deal, folks. But be that as it may, we're going to rule and reign with the Lord for 1,000 years, and then there's going to come a new world, a new heaven, and a new earth, you see. This old one put aside, done away with, and the new world, the world will go on forever, you see. It's going to go through a renovation, a restoration, a recreation. But man, we're going to live forever on the new world and in the new heavens, forever and ever in the ages to come. Man, I am not a doom and gloom kind of guy. I believe the best days are right around the bend. I believe we'll soon be in the kingdom, in heaven, and in the new world, the new earth, the new heavens that He's preparing for us. Is that day approaching? You bet. I'm convinced of it. Why? If you have a Bible and you want to flip there. If not, you can just listen in and jot scriptures down, or you can just, if you want, listen carefully. But I believe that we are upon those times when the rapture of the church is going to take place. For in Matthew chapter 24, a very key passage called the Olivet Discourse, as Jesus sat upon the Mount of Olives, and that's why it's called the Olivet Discourse, verse 3 of chapter 24 of Matthew. His disciples came unto Him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of Thy coming and of the end of the world?" Ah, you say, there it is, John, end of the world. Wait a minute. If you have a Greek New Testament, the word world there is aion, A-I-O-N, which means the end of the age of grace specifically. Not the world physically, but the end of the age. For you Bible students, you guys that want to study this through, check it out and you'll see it's true. It's the end of the age. The disciples say, what are going to be the signs, man, of Your coming and the end of this age of grace? Well, He gives one significant sign that stands out to me that I want to key off of this evening. He says in verse 32, after talking about many things that you can think through and study on for yourself, He says, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree." Learn a parable of the fig tree. The fig tree would, in their minds, immediately speak to them as the national symbol of Israel. If we talk about learn a parable of the eagle, we would think of our national symbol. If I was speaking in Moscow, if I said learn a parable of the bear, they would think of their national emblem, the bear over in Russia, you see. Now in Israel, the national symbol of the nation, historically and biblically, has been the fig tree. Jeremiah 25, Joel chapter 1, Hosea chapter 9, as well as a picture in Matthew chapter 21. The picture of the fig tree, the symbol of the fig tree, is understood historically and biblically as being Israel. Now, learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender, it porteth forth leaves when it comes back to life after the dead of winter. You shall know that summer is nigh. Watch this. So likewise, when you shall see these things, what things? The budding, the coming back to life of Israel after a season of winter's death. The coming back to life. When you see these things, know that he, literally, as your margin renders it, or if you have a newer translation, that he is near, Jesus is near, even at the very doors. Verily, and I love this man, verily, verse 34, I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be fulfilled. What generation? The generation that sees the fig tree blossom. When did the fig tree come back to life after a long winter of seeming death? The generation that saw that fig tree blossom is you. May 14th, 1948, after 2,000 years of seeming death, suddenly the nation Israel springs back to life miraculously when the United Nations, because of reacting against the horrors of the Holocaust of Nazi Germany, allows Israel to be a nation again. The fig tree comes back to life. Israel becomes a nation. Wait, you say, I've got a problem with that passage. And some raise this question and say, look over at Luke 21. Okay, let's look at Luke 21. Go to Luke 21. And there we see in verse 29, as Jesus, again, talking about the same subject, the end times. Luke 21, dealing with the same issues, the signs of his coming, when he would be at the very door, and he uses this analogy, the fig tree, once more. Behold, verse 29, the fig tree and all the trees. Aha, they say. The parable isn't just about the fig tree, but about all the trees. Watch this. Now, when they shoot forth, and you see and know your own selves that summer is now nigh at hand, so likewise, when you see these things come to pass, know that the kingdom of God is nigh at hand. Wait a minute, people say. In Matthew 24, it was talking about a fig tree, but now it says other trees, all the trees. What meaneth this? Let me tell you. There's a trio of trees to consider. Now listen, students. May 1948, three trees sprung to life together that have huge ramifications for the end time scenario. The same month of the same year, something happened in May of 1948. Number one, Israel became a nation. Within 2 weeks, there was the start of the European Union in May of 1948, the 10-nation confederation that will dominate the world in the end time scene from which Antichrist will rise. I'll talk about that in a moment or an hour. And the third thing that happened in May of 1948, simultaneous with the same month of Israel springing to life and the European Union beginning under Churchill's leadership, in the same month, the World Council of Churches started in Netherlands. The end time ecumenical movement to bring all religions into one umbrella. And we're going to talk about, Lord willing, he is, I think, those three trees springing out, shooting out their branches in harmony, the same month of the same year, three correlating, corresponding events that all point clearly to the times in which we're living. The trio of trees, the 10 nations, the nation of Israel, and the World Council of Churches, or the ecumenical movement. Well, this ecumenical movement, just real parenthetically, is described in Revelation chapter 13. A beast is coming, and when you hear the word beast in Revelation, think not some bizarre-looking creature. That's God's perspective of human leadership. The beast, the Antichrist, called the first beast, and the false prophet, called the second beast, will be smooth, charismatic, powerful personalities that the world will applaud. But from God's perspective, the beastly nature and the diabolical plan that is within them is repulsive and repugnant. And this second beast, first beast is Antichrist, second beast is like a lamb with two horns, but he speaketh as a dragon, Revelation 13 says. The lamb speaks with the two horns of, he'll seem to be a Christian, but lambs don't have horns. There's something abnormal, something bizarre. Lambs don't speak like dragons. Well, this one will, because in reality, he'll be a tool of the devil. This man that appears to be a lamb, this man that appears to be a Christian, a leader, in fact, with his horns of authority, a leader of Christianity will appear. And Revelation goes on to point out very clearly in 17 verse 9, and stay with me in this study, don't tune out here, but that he will rule and reign. And here we are told in Revelation 17, 9, the mystery of where this man will reign. He'll reign on the city of seven hills. You ask any person, any historian, from any viewpoint philosophically or religiously, what is historically the city of seven hills? And everyone will answer, if they have any kind of educational credentialing at all, the city of seven hills is Rome. This man that appears to be a Christian, who is all powerful and has authority and seems to be a real leader, will actually have his center of power from the city of Rome. Don't tune out. I'm going to get a lot of trouble if you tune out. Stay with me on this point. We'll talk about what this means later before you jump to too many conclusions. Now, Post Office Box 1018, Jacksonville, Oregon, 97530. Now, all three trees bud simultaneously, and I suggest to you that as we go through our quick survey this evening, we're going to see that the fruit on all three trees is ripened, ready for picking. Israel, the ecumenical movement led by a powerful figure from Rome, ecclesiastically or churchily, and the 10-nation European Confederation. Well, let's start with Israel real first. Tree number one, real first, real fast. Tree number one. Israel, of course, in the past year has been in the headlines big time, particularly since September 4th of this last year, when a young 25-year-old lawyer, Yigal Amir, shot down Yitzhak Rabin. And when that happened, were you watching? Boy, I've been holding my tongue on this issue, waiting for this evening. I hope you were watching. I hope you were reading. I hope you were looking, because, you see, there is some interesting things that happened. The whole world was caught off guard by the amount of sentiment that was pouring in and the attention focused on this particular murder, this particular assassination. Nations that had no diplomatic relationship with Israel whatsoever called for national days of mourning and fasting. Nations like India. In fact, there at the funeral, there was representatives from Israel's arch enemies, including Oman and Qatar, other countries that have nothing but animosity towards Israel historically, suddenly show up. The whole world comes to the funeral of Yitzhak Rabin. And there we heard his wife, Leah, say, "The greatest legacy of my husband is that of tolerance." Tolerance? Isn't that what the Jewish people have historically desired disastrously? To be accepted, to be like all the other nations, to be one of the countries? And Leah went on to say words that shocked many of us when she said concerning Benjamin Netanyahu, who, if you're not aware of Middle East politics and the scene in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu is a great leader of the Likud party. He's intelligent, he's articulate, and he believes in the Bible. Benjamin Netanyahu, a man that leads the Likud, Leah Rabin, the wife of the slain prime minister, said, and I quote, "I would rather shake Yasser Arafat's hand than Benjamin Netanyahu's." Why would she say that? Because she and her husband were committed towards tolerance
and acceptance. Yitzhak Rabin himself, and I quote, said, "The dusty old book of contracts, the Bible, has no meaning for us today. We must not look to the Bible for the map of Israel." A Knesset member stood up, and I quote, saying, "If there is a conflict between democracy and your faith in God," as he addressed those Jewish legislators, "you should put your faith in democracy." And Yitzhak Rabin seconded the statement. Yitzhak Rabin, a military hero, but a man who was determined to ignore what the Word has to say and what history has taught about the land of Israel. So, obviously, a man who was embroiled in controversy. You recall the handshake between Yitzhak and Yasser there on the White House lawn last year, 2 years ago now. The pained look on Yitzhak's face, knowing that what was happening was unsettling, to say the least, because the architect behind the whole Oslo agreement, the giving back of land that Yitzhak, pushed by his wife Leah, was agreeing to, was designed by Shimon Peres, who is now the prime minister. In fact, when Shimon Peres, the suave, sophisticated looking and talking man who now is in the seat of power, the new prime minister, when he was sworn into office, I found it interesting that there was an earthquake that day in Israel, 6.2 on the Richter scale. Because I think things are being shaken up radically by Shimon Peres. You see, the name Peres, P-E-R-E-S, if you're a Bible student, if you're really into it, it may ring a bell or two. Do you recall what happened there in the palace of Belshazzar? There was handwriting on the wall as they were partying there in Babylon, making fun of the Jewish people. Meni, meni, tekel, upharsin. And the word there, upharsin, was translated there in Daniel 5. Look it up later. It's in capital letters as P-E-R-E-S, Peres, which means divided. The land is divided. Interesting. More than coincidental, at least in my thinking, the handwriting is on the wall. This man, Shimon Peres, is behind the whole deal to divide the land that God has given to the Jewish people. And the handwriting is on the wall. There is trouble ahead. There has to be. Shimon Peres dividing the land, even as his name suggests from Daniel chapter 5. Now, in the assassination, there is a great mystery. And I want to run this by for you quickly. And I want you to keep your eyes open, and I want you to keep watching the news stories as they unfold. And you're going to have to look carefully, because immediately after Rabin was killed, Avishai Raviv, R-A-V-I-V, leader of Eyal, E-Y-A-L, which is a radical Jewish group, was arrested. But here's the kicker. Raviv, this man that's leader of Eyal, is also discovered to be, maybe you read this story, it was in our papers as well, was discovered to be an agent of the GSS. Now you say, what's the GSS? Yes. No. GSS. It is the counterintelligence agency that infiltrates these various organizations, and the GSS has responsibility to protect the prime minister, like our Secret Service. The GSS goes into groups as a counterintelligence group or arm, and then they also, once they discover what's going on, have responsibility to protect the prime minister and his family. Now, this is where the plot thickens. This man, Ravi, who was leader of Eyal, the radical Jewish group, was in reality a GSS agent. And he was the one who brought the Hitler posters, the posters of Rabin dressed up like Hitler, that were plastered around the rally there when he was gunned down. And before that event of gunning down Rabin took place, the cameras were directed to focus on these posters that very possibly he put in place himself. To do what? Well, when the gun was shot, a great mystery that Israel is still sorting through, that you'll be hearing about, is how could this man have gotten so close? How could he walk up to the prime minister? Where was the GSS? But immediately upon the firing of the gun, Leah Rabin was told, don't worry, those are only blanks. And immediately at the same time the gun was fired and Leah Rabin was assured that her husband was not hurt, that they were simply blanks being fired, at the same time, a radical Jewish group issued a statement saying, we missed the prime minister this time, but not next. But the statement came out simultaneously with the going off of the gun. Too quick. And so, I'm not trying to be Oliver Stone, believe me. I'm not trying to buy into some weird conspiracy theory. I'm saying for you to read the paper, to watch reports, because there's a great mystery about this assassination. It would seem at this point, it is very, very possible that this was an attempt by those within the GSS to smear all of the radical Jewish groups that are saying, don't give back the land, by making it look as though there was an assassination attempt that was actually set up by people who were involved with the GSS. It was supposed to be blanks in the gun, but it was obviously botched. And this young lawyer somehow found himself putting in real bullets and killing the prime minister, walking up to him, no resistance, no problem getting right next to Rabin, firing him, even though the immediate word to his wife was, don't worry, those are just blanks. And it would appear to many, and we'll see, because I hope that there is a full investigation, I hope that this man, Amir, who fired the shots, is not murdered. I hope that we get to the bottom of this discrepancy, this story. Israel is watching. We should be too, because it could very well be that it was an assassination planned by those in the GSS to smear the right wingers, to push forward the peace process. Well, the peace process has indeed been pushed forward, even though Rabin's life has been lost. Now, attention is focusing on Jerusalem. Surprising to many, when Rabin was gunned down, the thought was, oh no, there goes the peace process. But in reality, things are cooking. In fact, in the San Francisco Chronicle a couple of weeks ago, maybe you saw the story, huge articles. Academics ponder Jerusalem's fate. Israelis, Palestinians try to resolve thorniest issue. Recent leaks in the Israeli press have revealed that Israel and Palestinian academics are meeting secretly here and abroad to discuss what is potentially the most thorny issue facing the peace process, the city of Jerusalem. And it goes on to talk about what they're seeking to do quietly and covertly, although now it's picked up by the Chronicle. But nonetheless, in seeking to come together and solve the issue of Jerusalem. Why do I point this out to you? Because if you wish, turn with me, or at least jot it down in your notes or be aware of this, in Zechariah. We read in chapter 12 one of the key understandings of end-time Bible prophecy. Now stay with me here, because this is important as you watch current events unfold in this next 24-month period, as Jerusalem is preparing to celebrate its 3,000th birthday. Huge celebrations are being planned. Watch this. In Zechariah chapter 12, the Lord speaking in verse 2, behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about. In Zechariah chapter 12, the Lord speaking in verse 2, behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about. In that day, verse 3, I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people, and all that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. The world was gathered together, if you would, for Jerusalem as long as Rabin and Perez are giving away the city and giving away the land. But ultimately, Jerusalem is going to be a cup of trembling, a problem, an unsolvable difficulty. Why? Jot these scriptures down. Psalm 132, verse 13, where we read, "The Lord hath chosen Jerusalem. He hath designated it for His habitation." The Lord hath chosen the city of Jerusalem for His habitation. God is declaring, "That's my city." The psalmist would call it the city of the great king in that song that we sing around here not infrequently. It's His city. But what's happening? In 1993, for the first time ever, it's so shaky, it's so difficult in Jerusalem, it's so thorny, that more Jews moved out of the city than moved into the city. Even the Jews themselves are leaving Jerusalem. A net loss of 6,149, according to the Jerusalem Post, February 4th, 1995. The Jews themselves are fleeing the city. Why? Because of the tension. It's shaky. It's a problem city. It's crazy what goes on there. Because, you see, it is the holy city to 1 billion Catholics, 400 million Orthodox adherents, 400 million Protestants, not to mention the Jews and the Muslims, Islam. Now, if you're going to put together the pieces of this past year and what's coming up in the next 24 months, you need to listen carefully to why this is really an unsolvable problem, humanly speaking. Jerusalem being claimed not just by Christians, but the pieces of this past year and what's coming up in the next 24 months. You need to listen carefully to why this is really an unsolvable problem, humanly speaking. Jerusalem being claimed not just by Christians and not just by Jews, but by Muslims. Muslims, their third most holy site, Jerusalem. But even though that's what they say, the third most holy city behind Mecca and Medina, then comes Jerusalem, it is not one time mentioned in the Quran, their Bible. Not once. In fact, folks, you need to know this. In Islam, in Muslim writings, they believe, the Quran teaches, that Abraham and his son, the promised son, Ishmael, never even lived in the area we call Israel today. That Abraham and Ishmael lived 1,000 miles south in Mecca. Which raises a huge question, which is in the news this week concerning Hebron, where Abraham is buried. Remember, that's where 29 were shot down 2 years ago by Dr. Baruch. Hebron going back to the Palestinians because they're claiming it, because that's where Abraham is buried, both the Jew and the Muslim say. But wait, if the Quran teaches that Abraham and Ishmael, the promised son, they don't recognize Isaac, were down in Mecca, then why did Ishmael bury Abraham 1,000 miles up north in Hebron? Why would he take his dad's dead body into an area that he never went to previously and bury him in Hebron? Slight problem for Islamic scholars, believe me. So you say, well, what's the deal with Jerusalem then? Listen, never mentioned by Muhammad, never mentioned in the Quran. Then who started making Jerusalem the third most holy site? This is great. It happened way back in history, way back in 1933. How? Yasser Arafat's uncle. You know Yasser, that lovely character? Yasser Arafat's uncle, Haj Amin el-Husseini, was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. And he started the legend, he, in the 1930s. Now, when you're talking Middle East, folks, 1930 is nothing. In the 1930s, Yasser Arafat's uncle started the legend that from the Jerusalem Temple Mount by the Dome of the Rock Mosque, Muhammad ascended into heaven. He, who is the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, said, this is the place. That's why this mosque called the Dome of the Rock Mosque, built in, the 600s. That's why this mosque is here. Because this is where Muhammad ascended up into heaven. Now, what did he base that upon? One verse in the Quran, Surah, S-U-R-A-H, 17:1. I'll read the verse to you. Quote, glorified be he who carried his servant Muhammad by night from the inviolable place of worship, Mecca, to the far distant place, Al-Asq, the far distant place of worship. And Yasser Arafat's uncle said, the far distant place, Al-Asq, is here by the Dome of the Rock Mosque. And they then declared that to be the far distant place, based upon what? Nothing. Zero. Just said, this is the far distant place. This is the one verse that they use. Now you say, well, could it be? Let me ask you this. If you've been to Israel, and many of you have, all around the Dome of the Rock Mosque, there are verses from the Quran, all around the outside as well as inside. Not one of them mentions this verse. If this was the basis of truth, don't you think this verse would be mentioned somewhere in all of the verses that are inscribed mosaically in the mosque and around the mosque? They never even used this verse until 1933 when the Grand Mufti, Yasser Arafat's uncle, said, we need to make a mark here in Jerusalem. Why was then the Dome of the Rock built? Abd al-Malik built it in 691. Why? Simply for one reason. Not to commemorate Muhammad. That was never even talked about. But to stop the Jews from building their temple. That's the whole deal. What is that Dome of the Rock Mosque? You've seen pictures of it. It's that great big dome, the gold dome there in Jerusalem. So many pictures are taken of it. Built by the Muslims to do what? To prevent the Jews from building their temple. That's the only reason. This Muhammad legend didn't start until the 1930s. The Quran, in fact, never mentions Jerusalem. It's not once mentioned. Nor Canaan, nor Palestine. It talks about Mecca, man. It's 1,000 miles south, you see. It has nothing to do with Jerusalem. Yet Jerusalem is mentioned 800 times. 800 times in the Bible. Over and over, it's referred to in one way or another as the city of the great king. So, track with me. If this be the case, if it's a sham propagated by the Grand Mufti, Yasser Arafat's uncle, what's the reason? Why have they chosen to make Jerusalem the third most holy site? Why is this the issue that's in the news? And it will be, if you watch your front headline pages in the coming months, it's all going to be about Jerusalem. It already is. Why? Lance Lambert is right. He says, Israel has no great rivers. Not when you consider the Nile in Egypt, the Euphrates up north. It makes the little Jordan look like this creek behind here in comparison. Israel has no great rivers. It has no oil. It has no gas, no coal, no diamonds, no gold. Israel has nothing that countries would desire normally. Lance Lambert says this, the conflict is very simply one of religion. That's the whole deal. Religion. Jerusalem is the cup of trembling that Zechariah speaks of. It's going to lead to the whole end time deal, even as you are watching in the news presently, because of religion. You see, Jerusalem is in the holy crescent of Islam. And Islam, and keep this in mind when you see Louis Farrakhan pop on TV with his Million Men March and all that stuff. Islam is not one of the three great monotheistic faiths. that we often hear talked about in pious tones by religious people. Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, the three great faiths, that is blasphemy. Islam teaches directly that it supersedes and replaces Christianity and Judaism. And in the Holy Crescent of their territory, where by the year 2000, one-third of the world will be Islamic. Because people are so hungry for the discipline it brings. Man, if you're caught raping, you'll never rape again. Not in Islamic jurisprudence. If you're caught stealing, they'll chop off your hand. You're not going to do it again. This raises the most interesting point in my thinking. I've often pondered why in the book of Revelation, in the end times, when there is one world religion, how could it be that those that refuse to take the mark are beheaded? What an archaic, arcane way of execution. But there is one group that believes that beheading is the proper form of execution, and that is Islamic fundamentalism. Interesting. When the Bible talks about beheading being that which the Antichrist will use against those that refuse to submit to him. So what's the deal here? Islam is not an extension or an expression of monotheism. Of we have this common belief in God. Will Durant, and if you've been in college or whatever, that name rings a bell, in his classic monumental book, The History of Civilization, Volume 6, page 160 and following, says this, quote, and I quote, "In Kaaba," that's where Muhammad started his gig, "there were numerous idols, one whose name was Allah. Allah was the tribal god of Quraysh. Allah was the moon god, and thus we see in Islam today the crescent moon with the star. Allah was one of hundreds of gods. He happened to be Muhammad's favorite. Muhammad, if you know your history, went there into Kaaba and smashed the other idols, but said, we're going to continue to worship Allah. He will be the one true God, the God of the moon God. He's an idol. And that is why, listen, when you're talking to an Islamic person, whether in Saudi Arabia or Louis Farrakhan and the boys in Washington, D.C., they will always use the word Allah and not God. Always. They will never... You see, we use the word God. And we say, in Spanish, it's Dios. In France, bleh, you know, over there. In France, it's Dieu. Every language has a name for God. And what do you call God? Dios or Dieu or whatever language you might speak. Hey, it's God. But not Islam. They reject all of that in any language, in every language. Their deity is referred to only as Allah. You've heard Mike Tyson. Well, I hope you haven't. But these guys that are converted to that, you see, inevitably will only use the name Allah. Because Allah is not Yahweh, is not God. He is an idol that was chosen by Muhammad to be worshipped to the exclusion of all others there at Kaaba. Now, Yahweh, our God, the God of the Bible, 500 plus times our God is talked of as being the God of love. In fact, in 1 John 4:16, we are told God is what? Love. But listen, Allah, only one time is the word love connected with Allah. And I quote to you from Surah 61:4. Allah loveth those who battle for his cause. That's the only time that love and Allah are used together in the entire Quran. So when you read articles in Newsweek, as you will and are, about the Million Man March and Promise Keepers being linked together in this new movement, don't buy it. The Million Man March and the Islamic movement as a whole and all of its various parts and components are not worshiping God. They're worshiping an idol that has been selected by Muhammad to be the deity that is worshiped exclusively. But here's the problem, back to our story. As long as Jerusalem is not controlled by Islam, Jerusalem and Israel being in the Holy Crescent, it means that Allah is impotent. It's a battle between Allah and Yahweh, the God of the Jew and the God of the Christian. That's the whole gig, folks. That's the whole deal. If you don't grasp that, you'll never understand what's happening in the Middle East. It's a confrontation, whether Allah is powerful or whether it's Yahweh. Now, the Jews aren't standing up for Yahweh, which is most interesting, and I'll talk about that momentarily. But Islam is determined to destroy the Jewish presence from Jerusalem. Listen to what Yasser Arafat said in 1994 at a Johannesburg mosque. Arafat called for a jihad, a holy war by Arabs to retake Jerusalem. He didn't know it, but somebody was recording that speech, and it got out. And you read about it in the papers, and we talked about it last year. Well, Arafat was asked to explain, how could you, after signing these peace treaties, how could you call for a holy war for Arabs to take Jerusalem? How could this be? And Arafat hemmed and hawed and said, well, there's peaceful jihads too, you know. Now, if you know anything about Islam and about the Quran, to say there's peaceful jihads or peaceful holy wars is like saying there's non-explosive nuclear exchanges. It just doesn't ring true. It doesn't work. It doesn't fit. It's impossible. And yet that's what Arafat said. But in the same speech that was being recorded in that mosque in Johannesburg, South Africa, he said, and I quote, "This agreement between the PLO and Israel is not unlike our Muhammad and Quraysh." There's that word again, Quraysh. Now, what is Quraysh? When Muhammad was just coming into power, his own tribe, the Quraysh people, from which he chose this God, Allah, to unify his people, to be the monument or to be the deity of his movement, you see, he made this agreement with the Quraysh leaders. He signed a peace treaty, because Muhammad was not yet powerful enough to seize control of Mecca, his goal. He made a peace treaty 2 years later when his power increased. He took his troops and destroyed, butchered every single Quraysh leader. And how could he, a holy man, do this? He said, there's a new principle, a divine revelation called Quraysh. And that is, there is justifiable rightness in lying to achieve your ultimate goal if it's in the name of Islam. Quraysh is a term that the Islamic theologian is very aware of. Muhammad made a whole doctrine. Muhammad built his whole deal on that. Arafat, you know Arafat, the guy with the hat? He says, the deal that we have made with Israel is Quraysh. In other words, it's a temporary deal in the name of peace until we're strong enough to kill. Very simple. Now, everybody in the Arab world, everybody in the Islamic world understood what he meant, except, guess who? Americans and Jews. We tend to say, oh, well, he's carried away, but really we don't need to worry about that. John, I don't like the tone of this discussion tonight. You say, you're sounding to me like you're pro-Israel and anti-Arab. Wrong. But that's not really where I'm coming from totally. I understand the sentiment, I agree. But yet, listen, folks, listen carefully to what I'm about to say. It is not a matter of being pro-Israel and anti-Arab. That is not the issue, you see. This whole issue of Jerusalem and the West Bank and the turning over of these lands by the Jews to the Palestinians, so-called, not the issue of the Jews giving their land. You see, that land is not the Jews to give. It's God's land. It's not a matter of being pro-Israel or pro-Arab, anti-Israel or anti-Arab. It's a matter of saying, Father, what do you declare in your word? What does he say? Again, Psalm 132:13, the Lord hath chosen Jerusalem and desired it for his habitation. Genesis 12:1-3, jot it down. The Lord says to Abraham, I am bringing you to a new land. Leave where you've come from. Where Abraham was worshiping who? The moon goddess. Most interesting. Because what is Allah? The moon god. Leave the moon goddess and come and worship me, Yahweh, the true and living God, and I will bring you into a new land. Abraham was converted to the true and living God, Yahweh, away from the idolatry of that region that has its now outworking in Islam. Man. Come. And then the Lord says, listen, and I will bless those that bless thee, and I will curse those that curse thee. You see, I am for the Arab. I am for the American. I am for the Jew. I am for everyone to realize what God says. If you bless those whom the Lord has given that land to, that nation, that people, Arab, American, or Jew, will be blessed too. How do I know? Take a quick look at me, with me, not at me, please. Take a quick look with me at two neighboring countries, side by side, Israel and Jordan. Roughly the same demographics and population. Israel, 5.4 million people this year. The gross domestic product, for you guys that are into economy, the GDP, $61.5 billion last year, which comes to $11,600 per person. Not bad. They prospered. That's per person, for man, woman, teenager, child, baby. Right across the river, Jordan, 4.5 million, same size roughly, GDP, $5 billion, $1,100 per person. Listen, Israel is so prosperous because God said they would be. And God says anybody that blesses Israel is going to prosper too. It is my firm conviction that this country has been propped up politically and economically for one reason and one reason only. Our nation has blessed Israel, and consequently anyone who blesses those people in that land will be blessed. I am pro-Arab. I would tell all of my Arab friends, the best thing you can do is give the land to Israel. If you give the land to Israel, all the land, they have jurisdiction, but not domination. The Bible doesn't teach that. But they will have jurisdiction over the land, and you will prosper. If you bless Israel, whatever nation you're from, whatever ethnicity is in your heritage, you bless Israel, you get blessed. You curse them, and you'll be cursed. Look at Jordan. Look at the Arab region. Poverty. Dissension. Because they have cursed Israel, and they are reaping now their own destructions. Now, Jeremiah 7:7, God says to Israel, I will cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. I give you this land. It is not for Shimon Peres or Yitzhak Rabin to give back, because it's not theirs to give. God's land was given to the Jew forever and forever. That's the fact of the matter. And those that understand it will be blessed, and those that come against it shall be cursed. But the problem is in the region, Israel itself, for you see, God goes on to say, quote, when you shall do my statutes and keep my judgments, you shall dwell safely in this land. Have they? Israel is trying to dwell safely in their land today without doing his will. Item January 21st, 1995, Jerusalem Post article, quote, why do we coddle wife killers? And I read to you quotes from that article. Psychologists calling for education and treatment for murderers as wife killing is now a weakness resulting, they say, from one's childhood hurts. Wife killing is now epidemic in the nation of Israel. And they're saying it's because of childhood hurts of the killers. It's the Menendez deal. Drug addiction that was not known 15 years ago is now 200,000 hard drug core addicts in Israel. Auto thefts, one every 7 seconds in Israel. Israel Supreme Court last year at this time handed down a decision, legal rights for homosexuals and lesbian couples. This is in the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. You've got to wonder, of course, I read this article about Al Gore. Vice President Al Gore and his wife Tipper reached out to the homosexual community, entertaining 150 political activists at a party in their personal home. The pianist played show tunes and a pet Labrador begged at the buffet table. As officers and members of the Human Rights Campaign Fund, the homosexual lobby rubbed elbows with the Gores on Friday night. It's a wonderful thing to do what you're doing, and that's devoting your lives to others, Mrs. Gore told her homosexual guests. This dedication is an outgrowth of the way your entire community lives. We very deeply share your vision of a society that is fair and free of discrimination for gay and lesbian people. We want you to know that, Mrs. Gore said. And on it goes. And we wonder why our own country is crumbling. But sad to say, this is new in Israel. Drug addiction, homosexuality, auto thievery. The new code for the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, the finest troops in the world, man. They used to carry Torah, the Ten Commandments, with them. They used to go to Masada and say, never again on the hill of Masada. We will die defending our nation. Now Torah, the Ten Commandments, have been taken away from them, the IDF. And now they have, as of this year, the 11 core values, which include such biblical, theological concepts of reliability, camaraderie, responsibility, and purity of arms. Sad. I say that tongue in cheek. Sad. They've gotten away from their heritage, from the Word, from Torah, from the law, from Masada, their history, and now they're like every other country, humanism, platitudes of no religion, no connotation of Scripture, and they're suffering the consequences. Huh. And listen to what Shimon Peres said recently when asked a question by the Jerusalem Post of January 7th. Concerning the year 3000, the 3000th, pardon me, anniversary of Jerusalem, and David's driving out the Jebusites. David, their leader. David, the Star of David on their flags. Shimon Peres says, David's military victories were not acceptable to Judaism, and they're not acceptable to me. Close quote. Wow. What's happening in Israel? I'm one that travels there frequently. So is Phil Millier. Many others in here are as well. There is a decaying. There is a denying of their heritage. It's sad to say it's apparent to all that watch and see. In May 94, Shimon Peres, now the prime minister, offered to hand over sovereignty, quote-unquote, to Jerusalem, the old city, to the Vatican. December 31st, 1995, Jerusalem Post. In this proposition, Peres says, we're going to turn over the old city to the Vatican. There would be a Palestinian mayor and an Israeli mayor. The Vatican responded, Parade magazine, that little Sunday supplemental that you get, with Pope John Paul saying, quote, we trust that with the approach of the year 2000, Jerusalem will become the city of peace for the entire world, and all people will be able to meet there. In particular, the believers in the religions that find their birthright in the faith of Abraham, including Muslims.